This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, I'm Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. On May 17, 2011, the pilot of a Cirrus SR-22 found himself in a potentially fatal situation and probably didn't know it. He became incapacitated while climbing for 17,000, flying out of San Bernardino, California, for Colorado Springs. There were large mountains and clouds along the route. As the incident unfolded, a controller and commercial pilot flying for a regional carrier, Great Lakes Airlines, chimed in. Both the controller and pilot recognized what they thought were symptoms of hypoxia in the Cirrus pilot. They quickly began working together on frequency to help the Cirrus pilot's wife, who was also on the Cirrus, guide the aircraft away from mountains and through clouds to a lower altitude. We're speaking today to the pilot of the Great Lakes flight, Ian Norris, who was flying along with co-pilot Brad Hoganson that day. Ian, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Glenn. Glad to be here.
Not your average day at the office, huh, Ian?
Nope, yeah, it was a pretty exciting day. Got the adrenaline flowing for a little bit there.
Well, let's get some quick background on you. How long have you been with your current employer? What's your hours like, and what equipment were you flying for them at the time?
I've been with Great Lakes for just about 3.5 years. Been a captain for 2 years. And have just over 3,000 hours, and most of that on Beech 1900D, which I'm flying now. It's basically a giant King Air.
And how old are you?
25.
Now, before the incident, what was on your plate that day?
I believe that was the first leg of the day, flying out to LAX with stops in Farmington, Prescott, and ended up back in Prescott for the night.
How many passengers did you have aboard?
I believe about 10. I think it was about half full.
As you were flying along, what were the things you heard on frequency that convinced you there was a real problem going on?
When we first switched over to that Denver Center Control, we were about to begin our start of our descent into Farmington, and I heard the pilot of One Whiskey Alpha basically just mumbling the last three letters of his call sign, and heard some breathing noises at times, and he sounded like he was having some problems.
Why did you decide that you needed to get involved?
Both Brad and I have been through the high-altitude physiology training. I did mine at ASU campus down the altitude chamber there, and we both recognized the signs of someone who's hypoxic, how they talk, and you could tell they're working hard to think. So we both noticed it, and we knew he was in pretty deep trouble.
What were the first concerns of yours? What was on your mind, and what was the first help you offered?
The first concern when I heard his voice, honestly, I flipped our number two radio to emergency frequency 121.5, expecting to hear their ELT going off soon. I guess I thought the worst case scenario. We were descending just over the end of the south end of the Rockies there, and there were several cloud layers, and if they had an incapacitated pilot in the clouds near the Rockies, I didn't think they had a great chance, so I knew they had to get down, and the first advice I gave was to try to get them to start the descent on autopilot, so I told them to push the vertical speed button to try to get the plane to go down.
While you're starting to get involved with One Whiskey Alpha, at any time during the flight, did you inform your own passengers of what was going on up in the cockpit?
Yeah, I did about halfway through our descent. When we started to have to turn out of the way, I let them know. We were actually planning on landing in Farmington, so we didn't go that far out of the way. We were basically maneuvering around the approach area for Farmington, but we let them know we were helping a pilot in distress.
How did your involvement with the Cirrus alter your plans in the cockpit that day?
Anytime that Brad and I were silent on the radio, we were both talking about what's the best course of action to take. And a lot of it was trying to find them, and then we were talking about what advice to give them and you know, how much they could handle workload-wise.
On the audio, the FAA released audio of this event that we previously released here at AvWeb. It sounds to me like there's a point where you caught the aircraft, but you couldn't see it. It was in the clouds. What went through your mind then?
When we got down near their altitude, and we were still in the clouds, I became concerned because I know they might be in the clouds, and that's not a good situation. It's not good if they're in the clouds and the autopilot kicks off and the plane would lose control.
Throughout this, you're hearing a woman on frequency who seems to be taking action, too. It seems that she's on board One Whiskey Alpha with the incapacitated pilot. She's not incapacitated, but what was your perception of her?
It was a good thing. She seemed more lucid and was speaking clearly. You could tell she was flustered, but I had a feeling she had been in the aircraft and was obviously familiar enough to know how to talk on the radio, but I don't think she had any technical experience as to how to operate the aircraft. I had a feeling she'd be familiar with the autopilot buttons, as she's probably seen the pilot push them. That seemed to work. She knew what the vertical speed and heading and altitude buttons were. Well, I didn't want them to take the autopilot off, because I don't think that'd be a good thing to have the autopilot off and be in and out of the clouds.
It did seem like there was some confusion in One Whiskey Alpha about what was going on with the autopilot. I guess it's not entirely clear whether it was on, off, working, not working. It does seem clear that she didn't know how to work it well, and he didn't seem to have his wits about him to really work it properly. Is that pretty much your take on it as well?
Yeah, Brad and I both became concerned as we descended probably below 10,000 feet and the pilot was able to talk on the radio. I was worried if he couldn't figure out how to use the autopilot and maintain social awareness. I was worried what would happen if he tried to turn it off and make an approach to land if he was capable of hand flying the plane. And that's where I started to get worried. As we got lower, I knew there was a minimum altitude to use the parachute on the Cirrus. And I was just afraid he wouldn't be able to maintain control of the aircraft without the autopilot.
So you've got this aircraft that's out there wandering around, basically. There's a non-pilot flying the aircraft. The pilot appears to be incapacitated. ATC is working with her to help guide her away from rising terrain and through the clouds. When you did finally get eyeballs on the Cirrus, about how long into the event was that?
Probably about 15, 20 minutes into it.
And they'd been in and out of the clouds during that time? What's your best guess?
Yeah, I believe she said they're out of the clouds now. So I think they were in the clouds at one point. So I'm glad the autopilot was on then. When we got out of the clouds, we were able to find them. It was kind of hard because the Cirrus is a pretty small aircraft. And I think they were at a cruise power setting. So they were going about 160, 70 knots.
What did you think when you saw the airplane?
That was kind of in the realm of us worrying about if the pilot could handle the plane without the autopilot on, as he was becoming able to talk again. And we were observing the plane, seeing if how erratic his movements were. He was flying all over the place, but I think the autopilot was still on. And we were monitoring like our speed, too. I was checking that he didn't get too slow, but he kept the speed up pretty good.
Were you having to S-turn at all to stay behind him?
A little bit. We maintained separate IFR separation, visual separation the whole time. So at times it was kind of hard to keep him far enough away for safety reason, but keep him in sight. So we had to do some turns and such.
Throughout this whole thing, did you have any frustrations with what was going on? I mean, with how the controller was handling it or with how the pilot was interacting with you and the controller? What was going through your head?
I think the controller did a great job. If there's any frustrations, it was understandable that we had to keep the separation between the planes. I think you'd hear us a couple times saying if we could, you know, get lower, I'd be easier able to keep the plane in sight.
When the pilot began to regain his senses or seemed coherent and was appearing on frequency, it seemed to me you had some brief interaction. What's your interpretation of your interaction with the pilot of the Cirrus?
It reminded me of being in the altitude chamber when you're suffering from the symptoms of hypoxia. You don't really know it, and you think everything's fine. And I was kind of worried that was happening to him. He thought everything was fine, and the only problem was the autopilot wasn't working. And I kind of was thinking maybe he just doesn't know how to use it right now, and that he thinks everything's fine, and he wanted to climb back up to 17,000 and continue over the Rockies. And I'm like, that's not very smart thinking, so he's obviously not thinking clearly.
It seemed to me that out of everybody involved in this situation, you stepped up, I'd say most forcefully, making it known that you thought that continuing wasn't a good idea.
First, the controller was very keen to point out that he was hypoxic, but he was not telling the pilot to go down. He was giving him defensive pilot's discretion, and asking him if he needs any help, let him know. And I knew from altitude training that he doesn't know he needs help. He thinks everything's fine and that you need to get him down quickly.
What altitude was the Cirrus maintaining throughout most of this?
It started at 17, and he worked his way down 15 to 14, and he went back up a couple times. But as they got lower, he progressively got better and was able to talk again. And throughout the time, as he went lower, he got better.
Well, when he finally made the decision to land, were you comfortable with it?
Once I saw him pointing directly at Farmington, I was comfortable, but we were tailing him. Brad had him in sight for his base to final turn and said it was kind of shaky and steep, so I'm sure he was worried about that. But we were kind of pacing him on final, making sure he didn't get too slow.
Well, looking over the entire situation from start to end, the hypoxic, if that's what happened, pilot, the interaction with the controller, your engagement in the situation, what do you think are the lessons that you come away with? What are the lessons the rest of us can take from this experience?
If you're going to be operating in such a high-performance aircraft up in those altitudes, I think it's important to get training to be aware of the symptoms and signs of hypoxia. And you can see it also could help to train your non-flying pilots basic things like how to use the radio and how to push the straighten level button on the autopilot and things like that. That helped that the wife knew how to do that.
We've been speaking with Ian Norris, regional airline pilot for Great Lakes Airlines, man who went beyond the call, along with co-pilot Brad Hoganson. Their concern, urgency, and action may have helped save a fellow pilot's life. I'm Glenn Pugh for avweb.com. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.